Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, two banking giants get set to merge. What will it mean for regular consumers and mid-sized banks?
I don't think people were so wonderfully attached to these mid-sized banks to feel like that's a bad thing. They were already large, impersonal organizations anyway.
A new poll in Iowa shows four Democrats in a statistical tie.
An American doctor tells of bringing a hospital with her when she went to Iran to treat earthquake victims.
And well-intended foreign aid capsizes a thriving company in Ethiopia. We'll talk to USAID head Andrew Natsios about changes to the agency to make sure it helps rather than hurts.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. NASA's Spirit rover now has four wheels sitting on the Martian soil. The rover rolled off the lander early this morning. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Until now, Spirit has been about 16 inches above the Martian surface, resting on the deck of the lander that carried it safely to Mars. About 12:20 this morning Pacific time, mission managers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena sent a command to the rover to start the 10-foot drive off the lander. But while it was rolling, its radio was shut off. Mission managers had to wait 90 minutes to be certain everything went well. Shortly after 5 a.m. Pacific time, the signal came.
And there it is. That's what you're initially waiting for. We're now on Mars.
Now, the rover and its robotic arm can begin its geology mission to study the rocks and soil on Mars. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
There will be one less Democrat running for president when Carol Mosley Braun ends her bid for the White House later today, NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Throughout her campaign, Carol Mosley Braun said she was running for president because it was time to take the men-only sign off the White House door. In 1992, during what was dubbed the Year of the Woman, Mosley Braun became the first African-American woman to win a U.S. Senate seat, which she held for one term. Her effort to make history a second time during this presidential race fell flat as she struggled to raise campaign funds despite endorsements from the National Organization for Women and the National Women's Political Caucus. Political polls also showed the level of support for the former senator from Illinois never broke above single-digit percentages. Later today, Mosley Braun will officially throw her support to apparent Democratic frontrunner Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
A severe Arctic cold outbreak has descended on much of New England. National Weather Service meteorologist John Goff in Burlington, Vermont, says it'll get worse later today when the winds pick up to go along with temperatures only expected to reach 15 to 5 degrees below zero.
We do have wind chill warnings up for later today and tonight, and with the winds picking up in the 15 to 25 mile per hour range during that time period, we're looking at wind chill values approaching 30 to 50 below zero. At those levels, skin can freeze in 15 minutes or less.
At 6:30 this morning, it was 19 degrees below zero in Burlington and only 31 below in Berlin, New Hampshire. Farther south, schools in New York State from Buffalo to Syracuse are closed. Forecasters say as much as 10 inches of snow could fall in the Cape Cod area. One New England utility is asking customers to save energy. The cold snap could strain its power supply. On Wall Street, the Dow is up about 2 points to 10,540 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is down about 11 at 2099. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the government says retail sales rose last month, but at less than half the pace of the previous month. The smaller-than-expected rise caused some speculation as to whether consumers, whose spending has largely driven the economy in recent years, may be getting tapped out. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The figure showing retail sales up just 0.5% in December caps a somewhat disappointing year for retailers. Excluding automobiles, sales were up an even less impressive 0.1% last month. Cynthia Latta is an economist with Global Insight. She says one reason for the relatively weak sales numbers may have been price competition amongst the major retailers over the holidays.
Consumers have been trained to wait for the prices and the sales signs, and so I think what happened is that prices were very weak on a lot of these retail goods.
December sales figures from large retailers like Walmart and Target would seem to bear that out. Both chains say their sales were on the low side of estimates. Retail sales are closely watched since consumer spending drives roughly two-thirds of the economy. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
J.P. Morgan is buying Chicago-based Bank One for about $58 billion in stock. They are the nation's third and sixth biggest banks. The deal would come at a steep price for employees. As many as 10,000 workers could lose their jobs when the banks integrate their operations. Bank of America said today that fourth quarter earnings rose 4% to more than $2 billion. The bank reported gains in mortgages and investment banking. Still, commercial borrowing remains sluggish. Shares of Bank of America fell almost 2% in morning trading. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
There's been another huge bank merger. J.P. Morgan Chase will swallow up Bank One for some $58 billion in stock, creating the second largest bank in the United States. 10,000 jobs could be lost, which means trauma for those newly unemployed and their families. But what's this merger mean for the rest of us, if anything? We're joined now by Anil Kashyap, Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. Hello.
Hi, glad to be here.
Bank of America bought Fleet Bank a few months ago, as you know. Are big bank mergers happening more than in the past?
There's some perception that that might be the case, but it's not. It wouldn't really be true. In fact, there have been successive waves of bank consolidation going back for about 20 years when we started deregulating the banking industry. First, it was consolidation within the state, and then there was mergers across states, and then finally now we're seeing these nationwide mergers. So this has been something that's been going on for a long, long time.
Now, what does this mean for the average person who has an average bank account in a bank in their town where they go and they use the ATM and sign a check and maybe get a mortgage? Does this mean anything to the average person?
No.
Why not?
Because the banks have become relatively good at making this kind of thing seamless for the customer. If anything, it will mean that if you happen to be, say, a Bank One customer in Chicago and you find yourself in New York or Texas or some of the areas where Chase had branches before, you might be able to find a bank that will allow you to use the ATM without paying a fee. But for the typical person that's not jet-setting around the country, this is probably going to make relatively little difference.
So was deregulation a good thing for the big banks? They get to fire 10,000 people. They streamline their operations. Is that what it's all about? That's what it boils down to?
Well, I'd say it's been a good thing for consumers.
Okay. Tell me
first
how.
First of all, well, it does mean that the more efficient banks can serve more people. It was 25 years ago when there was only one branch per bank. You had things like banks being closed on Wednesdays. You didn't have ATMs. You didn't have lots of things. And I think on the whole, most people probably get much better banking services now than they did 20 years ago.
If you're a much smaller bank, are your knees now shaking, waiting for some banking conglomerate to swallow you up?
No, what's actually happened is if you think of the size distribution of banks. You have these huge, monstrous organizations like Citigroup or now Chase. And what they've done is they've acquired their national franchise through gobbling up the middle-sized banks. What we've got now is what people think of as kind of a barbell-shaped distribution. You have a lot of the bank assets held by these huge, huge organizations. But then you have thousands of small community banks where you can go in and the people still know you and all of that. It's the middle that's disappeared. And I don't think people were so wonderfully attached to these mid-sized banks to feel like that's a bad thing.
Hmm.
They were already large, impersonal organizations anyway.
Final question. You're in Chicago. Bank One's headquarters was in the heart of the Loop. A blow for Chicago's image as a banking center?
Chicago hasn't, frankly, been a banking power for at least 10 years. So in that sense, I don't think it really makes that big of a difference. Probably the biggest thing that will happen is if many of the highest level employees of Bank One do relocate to New York, there'll be a little less philanthropy in Chicago.
Hmm. Professor Anil Kashyap, speaking to us from the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The world's gaze has shifted from BAM Iran, but international aid workers are still trying to put the town back together. Between 30 and 32,000 people died in the earthquake last month, and then there was the physical devastation, crushed homes, injuries, and a sudden lack of basic amenities. Just 24 hours after the December quake, a medical team from Boston was deployed to BAM. Among them was Dr. Thea James, a member of the International Medical and Surgical Response Team and an emergency physician at Boston Medical Center. Well, she has returned to the States and spoke to us in the studio earlier today. We asked her about the biggest challenge facing the town of BAM.
Right now, I would imagine rebuilding the local infrastructure so that it would enable support for medical resources for people who have injuries that require rehabilitation at this time.
I would imagine there were thousands of broken legs.
Exactly.
And these people, where are they?
Well, if you could imagine people with broken legs living in tents, some of them that required surgical procedures were sent to other hospitals, but there are many people who came to us from tents.
Mm.
And we saw a significant amount of orthopedic injuries as well, as you might imagine from being buried under rubble.
So they have nowhere to recover.
Exactly.
That's the biggest need. Well, how does your team deploy? What do you do when you get there? What did you bring and how did you set it up?
Well, our team, the IMSERT team, which is the International Medical and Surgical Response Team, we have enough equipment and supplies to sustain ourselves for a limited amount of time. We take our hospital with us.
Mm.
We take our vehicles with us, our supplies with us. And as
vehicles
it were,
like ambulances and
trucks. And we take these things. And as it were, on this trip, we went on a military plane, a C-17, and we rode with all of this on this airplane. Once we arrived, we put our hospital up. And
what does that entail? What kind of thing?
It's a field hospital. And in it, we have an emergency department, an intensive care unit, an operating suite, as well as a section for short-term sort of inpatient care. And then we had a couple of separate tents. And culturally appropriate in this case, we had a tent for women and one for men, and those for like the walking wounded,
mm-hmm.
for less urgent cases.
Mm. Boy, I'm thinking that the Iranians, who are, you know, very sophisticated in Tehran, but out in the small town, that must have been amazing to see this land and spring up.
People came in droves. We were busy, very busy every single day.
Mm.
And it really wasn't uncommon for people to have just left another hospital, but they wanted to come to our hospital as well. Most of the injuries were orthopedic injuries that I saw. I was assigned to the emergency room, if you will. We saw people who had injuries that were the result of an initial insult that occurred probably on the day of the earthquake. And over time, this evolved into something that became a more emergent condition.
Like what? Like, for instance?
For instance, you can have a crush injury. And over time, this can deem your kidneys inoperable. Mm. They just don't work anymore.
Mm.
When your kidneys don't work, you build up electrolytes and things that are incompatible with life.
So people might have been pulled from the rubble and are just now having huge failures. And again, there's no buildings, no place to treat them.
That's right.
Right. It just must have been overwhelming.
I think if we look at it from the perspective of comparing it to what we see in overcrowded emergency departments and things now.
In Boston. Or any other American city, yeah.
Exactly. It may not have been overwhelming in terms of the volume and the numbers of people that we saw on a daily basis. However, you're not accustomed to people coming in and saying to you, I lost 15 people in my family, or I lost my wife and my children, and I only have my 80-year-old father here, and he hasn't eaten anything or he hasn't spoken a word since the day of the earthquake.
How do you leave, especially when there are so many children injured and orphaned?
It's difficult, although the objective of the team, we are a rapid response team designed to deploy any place in the world, but again, temporarily until resources are mobilized to replace us. So in your mind, you sort of know that you are there for a limited amount of time.
Dr. Thea James, emergency physician at Boston Medical Center and also a member of the Boston-based International Medical and Surgical Response Team. She just recently returned from BAM, Iran.
As each massive section of a 25-foot wall goes up in East Jerusalem, tensions between supporters and critics of the barricade go up, too. Israeli authorities say the 21-mile-long barrier is temporary, meant to prevent suicide bombers from getting through, like the Gaza woman who blew herself up yesterday, killing four Israelis and leading to today's shutdown of the Gaza Strip. But Palestinians say the wall blocks them from reaching their jobs, hospitals, schools they attend or teach at, among other things. We were told all that yesterday by a Palestinian professor at Abu Dis University in East Jerusalem. Today on the program, we cross over to the other side of the wall to talk to a Jewish professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Professor Menachem Hoffman teaches political science at Hebrew University. He joins us from his office. And, Professor, does the wall inconvenience you as it did our Palestinian professor yesterday?
I guess from my perspective, it looks different.
Sure.
I certainly sympathize with Palestinians that feel that their life disrupted by the wall.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, in Israel we call it fence, not a wall, but it is a terminology that affects other parts of the conflict as well.
Do you feel safer?
We do. Now, the wall is not completed yet, but in a way, in parts where the wall is completed, certainly in 2003, the number of casualties went significantly down. And therefore, most Israelis support the wall. I do have to say that there is a difference between the wall as a security measure and the location of the wall. Probably part of the resentment among the Palestinians, or also among Israelis, is that the wall is placed in many parts well inside the West Bank. And personally, I also would feel much better if the wall were built more or less along the Green Line.
Right, the 67 war lines, instead of intruding on Palestinians, say, and some Israelis, territory that the Palestinians have for many years considered their own. Just in the brief time we have left, the professor yesterday was concerned about getting people to the hospital in time, accident victims, women in labor. What do you say about that?
I would say that there is hierarchy among rights. And first comes the right to life. The main object of the wall is to make the entire area, and especially from the Israelis' point, safer and prevent suicide bombers and other terrorist activities. In that sense, if the wall is built along the pre-67 borders, I think not many people can object to it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the objection, as I mentioned, came because it is built on different lines and trying to draw the future borders. But as a security measure itself, I see Zwolle certainly as something that helps to save life.
Professor Menachem Hoffnung teaches political science at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you.
Just ahead, one man's story of being put out of business because of the generosity of the U.S.
And later in the show, a brand new poll in Iowa has four Democrats in a statistical tie.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There's an old saying that it's better to teach a hungry man to fish than to give him fish. Well, a variation on that story has unfolded in the last few years in Ethiopia. Ermias Amelga is an Ethiopian entrepreneur with an MBA from Boston University and a decade of Wall Street banking under his belt. He definitely knew how to fish in the waters of the free market and returned to Ethiopia in 1996 to start what in short order became a thriving cooking oil business. But he had competition. The U.S. Agency for International Development. Here to pick up the story is Ermias Amelga. He joins us on the line from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. And Ermias, welcome.
Thank you.
I said your business was thriving. Can you describe it at its height? How many employees? How much cooking oil?
Well, the factory had 180 employees. This was a state-owned factory which I'd bought from the privatization agency. The factory was a 30-year-old factory, well-established, you know, doing well. It was actually the largest factory in Ethiopia.
Well, and then what happened, in a nutshell?
Well, I mean, 6 months after I took possession of the factory, things had been going okay. And then all of a sudden, we had a major auction sale of U.S. aid oil. Had been sent to the U.S. aid office in Ethiopia, and the cash from the sale would be used for development programs and running U.S. aid projects in Ethiopia. Mm. And that clobbered the market. It was a huge supply that the local market couldn't absorb.
You began losing $30,000 a month, and you ultimately had to halt production, lay off all your workers, 180 people out of a job, and it's all because of a generous gift of aid.
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, prices within a day of the auction being announced, even before the oil was sold, collapsed 40-50%. And there's no way you adjust your operating margins to make up for that kind of squeeze. Yeah. So it wasn't just me. It was the whole cooking oil industry in Ethiopia that was affected.
Well, but there's something more to be overcome, because as you well know, American farmers are in part subsidized by U.S. aid. They heavily lobby the U.S. government to buy their food surplus to send to countries like Ethiopia. That's who you're competing with.
That's exactly what we're competing with, and it's a real issue because I understand, you know, U.S. politics. And I understand, you know, what's going on with farm subsidies and so forth, and that's something that's going to be with us for a while. The issue then is, you know, then who pays the price for that? If U.S. taxpayers are willing to pay the price for that, you know, that's okay. But when you're looking at third world countries that are poor as it is, looking for aid, and of course, you know, there's a humanitarian issue, and you have to feed people, but you have to do it in a way that doesn't affect or undermine longer-term development.
Once you got drowned, as it were, by American oil, you switched to something else?
Yeah, now I'm floating on Ethiopian water. I got into mineral water production. I was actually the first person in Ethiopia, and this was about 5 years ago, to introduce bottled water. That was a product that was imported from the Middle East and Europe, selling for about $2.50 US dollars a bottle. I started producing locally and started selling for about 50 cents a bottle. And that's what salvaged my existence in Ethiopia. And I'm even looking now within the next 6 months at exporting to neighboring countries. And I've got it in my targets over the next year or two to even try shipping some water to the U.S.
Well, we'll look
forward. You know, niche markets, water from Africa. I mean, you know, the irony of it, of course, would be water from Ethiopia.
Mm. Well, Ermias, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ermias Amelga, a businessman from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. We're joined now by Andrew Natsios. He heads the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And Andrew, I know that you're familiar with the story of Mr. Amelgas. How does this happen that foreign aid agencies think there's a cooking oil shortage when, in fact, there's a fine little company chugging along?
We actually go to great lengths in our development programs to ensure that we do not damage local businesses and disrupt markets. But in the mid-90s, there were some disruptions that took place in the whole food aid program in the U.S. government. And it's over now, but it did hurt some markets in some countries. We're very sensitive to this. We're required by federal law, the Bellman Amendment requires us to do a market survey before we can do food aid program.
But we also understand there are examples where aid agencies want to disrupt the local economy. I'm thinking of what happened in Somalia, in Mogadishu, when gunmen were stealing the wheat that aid agencies were sending and selling it at black market prices, that the idea was to just keep flooding the market so that there was so much wheat that it would have to bring the prices down.
That's exactly what happened. And in fact, we sold wheat on the markets in Mogadishu deliberately so that wheat would be less attractive for the gunmen to steal. And that's what happened. The level of violence diminished as the price diminished.
But we understand that, as many have said, there's a food aid fact of life, that foreign aid helps subsidize farmers in the United States. And you have a lot of lobbying from farmers who want you to send cooking oil rather than teach people how to make their own cooking oil.
No, we've never had the farmers, the Farm Bureau or any of the farmers' lobby groups actually say more food aid and less money for agriculture. But
there's a perception, though, Andrew, that there's a huge lobbying group. Their interest is that the U.S. government buy their surplus food to send it overseas.
Well, there is a perception of that, but the reality is that the amount of food aid the U.S. government buys through our program is so tiny compared to the amount of food produced by our farmers, it has almost no effect on the it's like a 1% or a half of 1% of the total amount of food produced by our farmers. So it really does not affect markets very much. And it's not from surplus. That used to be the case, and that program has been phased out, the surplus program.
Andrew, one last question before we let you go. In your mind, what is your biggest challenge as head of USAID?
Our biggest challenge is to allow the requirements of people in the field to drive policy rather than the opposite. What happens too much is that people in the capitals of Europe or Canada, the U.S., make decisions on aid policy that do not correspond with the realities in the field. And that's our biggest challenge right now.
Well, and that brings us back to Ermias Amelga and, you know, being careful not to put people like him out of business.
Right. Yeah. We want to encourage people like him.
I just suspect you want to hire people like him. That's true. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Natsios, yeah, head of the U.S. Agency for International Development. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Howard Dean finds a lot of company at the finish line in Iowa, where a new poll shows a dead heat for first.
Dean is the bull that went into the ring full of fire and has had nothing but picadors put the lances in his back. All of the other Democrats have been drawing his blood, and I think it's weakened him.
And jazz saxophonist Charlie Colhase brings decades of playing and listening to his new CD.
I think I've been influenced by nearly every record I ever owned, which if you come to my house, you'll see there's walls and walls of them.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Another Democrat is dropping out of the race for president. There's word that former Illinois Senator Carol Mosley Braun will switch her support to former Vermont Governor Howard Dean today. Florida Senator Bob Graham bowed out last fall. Braun has been the only woman in the race. Things are getting nasty in Iowa, where Democrats hold the leadoff vote for convention delegates next week. Frontrunner Dean says his challengers are going to do anything they can to stop him. He's denouncing one of them, Wesley Clark, as a closet Republican. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, along with Dean, Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt, and North Carolina Senator John Edwards are statistically tied for the lead in Iowa polls ahead of the caucuses next week. A winter storm is blasting the Northeast, bringing with it fierce winds, frigid temperatures, and snow, causing school closings, flight delays, and fender benders. Alan Dunham is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Taunton, Massachusetts.
Basically, it's coming right from the Arctic Circle. We have a very large Canadian high-pressure system centered in central Canada that extends just to the west of New England, and it's just drawing air right from the Arctic Circle across James Bay over on top of us.
In parts of Maine, the temperature plunged to 31 below zero. The governor has declared a civil emergency in Maine. There are new questions about the U.S. plan to return power to the Iraqis. That's apparently bringing Iraq civil administrator Paul Bremer back to the U.S. Sources say Bremer is due to meet tomorrow with National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and possibly with President Bush as well. The U.S. plan for transition to Iraqi self-rule is under review after demands by a Shiite Muslim cleric for full-scale direct elections instead of the provincial caucuses the U.S. is calling for. The Pentagon is asking for a deeper investigation of Halliburton. Pentagon authorities say Vice President Dick Cheney's former company should be investigated for possibly overcharging the military for gasoline delivered to Iraqi civilians. The request for a deeper probe indicates auditors found evidence of possible violations. And call it the can-do Spirit, a small U.S. space buggy named Spirit. Its wheels down on the planet Mars and is now exploring the Martian surface. It rolled off its lander this morning and is already beaming back photos of the red planet to Earth. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 6 points. The NASDAQ is down 8. The S&P is down a fraction. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Having been all but written off by several pundits in recent weeks, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry is suddenly writing a whole new political plotline in Iowa. The latest Reuters MSNBC Zogby poll shows Kerry with a very slight lead, just 1%, over former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. Dean in the same poll is tied for second with Missouri Congressman Richard Gebhardt, and not too far behind is North Carolina Senator John Edwards. In the past week, Kerry's gained 11 points on Dean in Iowa. Today, Dean will gain the endorsement of Carol Moseley Braun when she drops out of the Democratic race. Does that matter? Does Kerry's 1% matter? Joining us on the line are John Greenberg, executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, John.
Hi, Bill.
John, thanks for joining us. And Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Stefan.
Hi.
Stefan, a diminished Dean. Last week, he seemed to have a fairly commanding lead in Iowa. What's going on?
Dean is the bull that went into the ring full of fire and has had nothing but picadors put the lances in his back. All of the other Democrats have been drawing his blood, and I think it's weakened him. I think what it's done is it's stopped his momentum. I mean, he's been stuck in those numbers up in sort of, you know, 21-23% for a long period of time. He hasn't been gaining any momentum. And what the story is mostly is that the others are sort of now catching up because they're getting the support from undecided people, and also that people are playing musical chairs in some of the campaigns where there are either soft votes or where people have given up on waiting for Clark.
Stefan, is one possible way to analyze that Dean had this hard core of support that's kind of stuck and he just hasn't drawn anybody in really since the summer?
Sure, absolutely.
John, your thoughts on Iowa, even though you're up there in New Hampshire?
Well, my feeling is, and it holds as true, I think, probably for Iowa, as it does for New Hampshire voters, is that, you know, where we are right now in the season is sort of the political equivalent of whack-a-mole. You know the game, wherever the mole pops up, you want to whack it.
Right.
And whichever politician seems to pop his head up above the crowd, the other ones jump on and start beating up on him. And what I've noticed as much as anything else is that, to a slight extent, the other politicians gain, but mainly what seems to happen is that you see an increase in the undecideds. So I believe that the overall tenor of the campaigns right now is generating a lot of confusion. And the word that I'm getting both from the voters that I talk to in Iowa and here in New Hampshire is that they feel it's awfully late in the game to be as confused as they are.
Yeah, and as Stefan pointed out, Dean's been taking all the hits. Does it then happen that a Kerry, who, if he doesn't bring loads of charisma, brings a certain gravitas, seems more appealing? And the same thing maybe going for Wesley Clark, John, in New Hampshire, as he continues to make better numbers there.
Well, you know, both Kerry and Clark are taking hits now from other candidates. And in particular with Clark, Kerry and Dean have pointed out that Clark did some work for Republicans and actually became a registered lobbyist for a defense contractor. So Clark is not at all exempt from any of this treatment right now. And you see a lot of interest in Clark. By the way, John Edwards is not getting bad crowds either. But when you go to a Clark event, you have a lot of people who are interested but certainly not sold on Clark yet. And I think that he's dealing with a lot of volatility, too.
Stefan Schmidt, this volatility that we talk about, this even kind of turmoil at this point, is it also possibly a factor that there isn't one dominant personality in this group of nine, now to be eight, with Carol Moseley Braun dropping out?
Well, there's not only not a dominant personality, but there are also sort of three different or maybe two different Democratic parties, and they are having a titanic struggle to decide whether they want to go the direction of Bill Clinton and move as close to the center and try and win the election that way, or whether they ought to go the opposite direction, go back to the roots of the Democratic Party, mobilize the base, bring in people who in the past sat it out, and go with somebody who can project himself as more liberal and who can take on Bush from the opposite end of the spectrum, as opposed to taking on Bush from sort of, you know, close quarter, hand-to-hand combat with a knife. And I think that is very confusing. I've talked to a lot of party activists all over the state who are agonizing and wringing their hands because they all want to beat Bush. That's the, you know, that's the only thing that holds them together. But they're not sure whether it's going to be the insider Kerry or the outsider Dean seen, or the way outsider, sort of in outer space, Clark.
So many unpredictables here. John Greenberg, earlier you alluded to undecideds. I want to ask you both, how many are still undecided, John, in New Hampshire? And then I'll ask Stefan the same question.
Would have to put that number at least 20% of the voters, and possibly more than that, because I think that there are people who, when asked, say they're with a particular candidate, but they're willing to give it up.
How about in Iowa, Stefan?
We did a poll here in the political science department at Iowa State University, and it showed the same number, roughly. It's so hard to be, you know, undecided, because you look for, like, such a doofus. You know, people are saying, if by now you haven't decided, why don't you just stay home, because you're not going to get any more information by sitting there and saying you're undecided. All the candidates have oversold themselves. People can get access to everything except the type of underwear that they're wearing. And that may be even available on, you know, candidatesunderwear.org.
I'm absolutely sure it is. Yeah. Stefan, how unusual is it in Iowa a few days before the caucuses for a fifth of the electorate to be uncertain who they're going to vote for? And John, I'll ask you the same question. First step.
It's not unusual. And okay, when you actually look at the results in Iowa, I mean, there are years when undecided is the winner.
John Greenberg, New Hampshire, certainly loves to offer up a surprise to the whole country. A fifth of the electorate undecided, typical, a week and a half or so before the primary?
Not unusual, but actually not that familiar to a lot of the voters here in recent memory. You really got to go back to 92 when you had five Democrats running in earnest. And plus, a lot of the attack campaigning is just leaving people far more unsettled with any choice that they make. Because as soon as they make a choice, then they find out that that guy really wasn't quite as pure and clean as I thought he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, what am I supposed to do now?
Well, John, to finish up, if you were a betting man, what happens in New Hampshire?
Dean still holds on to about a 10-point lead. Dean's got an amazing get-out-the-vote organization.
Lots of money.
I would give it to Dean.
Dean. Stefan Schmidt out in Iowa, your prediction?
I think it'll be sort of Dean wins, Gephardt comes in, but not enough to survive this. And Kerry is a real threat. So I think it could be tight.
Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Stefan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And John Greenberg, executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. Thanks, John.
Anytime, Bill.
Still to come, versatile, venerable sax player Charlie Colhayes. He has a new CD.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our talk about Iran with Richard Perle, former chair and now member of the Defense Policy Board, provoked a lot of response. Michael Fager of Somerville, Massachusetts, summed up the opinions of many when he wrote, "I cannot believe that you let Richard Perle appear on your show as if he is a legitimate political commentator. This is a man who firmly believes that the purpose of public service is private enrichment. This is proven by the fact that he was forced to leave the chairmanship of the Defense Policy Board because he was using it to make money, for which he has been wholly unapologetic."
Many listeners also responded to our editorial roundtable last week, in which columnist Tom Maroney surmised that the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq had ceased to be an issue for the American people. Bill Seidel of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, writes, "Just ask the dead, the still dying, and their relatives, what did they die for? I'm one of many who still care, and I'm angry as hell at this P.T. Barnum of a president."
Well, our piece on President Bush's proposal to enable as many as 12 million undocumented foreign workers to work legally in the United States brought this response from Peter Martell of Bennington, New Hampshire. "This will result in lower wages for the blue-collar workers in America. The gap between rich and poor will grow even wider." What a brilliant move. The Republicans grab the immigration issue, make it a benefit for business people, tick off the unions, knowing the rest of the blue-collar folks will fall in line behind the Republicans over the patriotism issue.
Jake Elkins of Tucson, Arizona, thanked us for our story on illegal immigrants crossing the border in Arizona. Between 150 and 205 people died last year attempting to cross the desert. And Jake writes, even one death is too many. All of these deaths are a direct result of U.S. immigration policy to funnel migrants through the hottest, meanest desert on the border.
Jarama Valiente of Watertown, Massachusetts, chose to call with his thoughts after our report from the Detroit Auto Show.
I found it very strange that the interviewer didn't ask about hybrids. They asked them all about SUVs and all about all kinds of different things, but they didn't ask them any questions about the status and the future of hybrids and renewable energy and advances in that type of technology and mileage. They didn't mention anything about mileage. It was disturbing and peculiar, to say the least.
And finally, a Mrs. Suber from Charlotte, North Carolina, sent a correction after our feature on the age-old practice of shape note singing, which was recently featured in the film Cold Mountain. Mrs. Suber writes, a man in the segment mentioned that the Primitive Baptist Organization is the only religion in the U.S. which doesn't use instrumental music. On the contrary, many Church of Christ congregations sing a cappella exclusively. This segment brought back memories of almost forgotten shape singing I heard as a child growing up in Middle Georgia. Thank you for the memories.
And thanks for listening. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your town and your full name.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Sun Ra's 1950s hit Super Bronze, recorded now by the Charlie Colhase Quintet. Not to be confused with the group CK5, the Either Orchestra, or a number of other Boston-based jazz bands associated with the venerable sax player Charlie Colhase, who has finally released a live recording. The title, Play Free or Die, is a nod to Charlie's home state, New Hampshire, whose motto, of course, is Live Free or Die, and to Charlie, living and playing is the same thing. Charlie Colhase joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Glad to be here.
This release is from your quintet, but how many bands are you in or have you been in?
Oh, I have a hard time counting, but I think it's something around six right now.
Yeah. All that, and he still finds time to anchor overnights here at our home station, WBUR in Boston.
I just need something to do at night.
At night, so. Can keep you busy. Well, reviewers are always saying good things about you, first of all, but they're always also saying that they hear, you know, Charlie Mingus, Thelonious Monk, Ornette Coleman in you. So, first of all, what do you hear in you?
Well, I hear a whole amalgamation of decades and decades of jazz because I listened voraciously to jazz music. I love the music.
And I think I've been influenced by nearly every record I ever owned, which if you come to my house, you'll mm-hmm. see there's walls and walls of them.
Yeah.
So it's an amalgamation of things I've heard over the years that I'm starting to get to come out the way I hear them now.
Both interpretations of other people's work and your own work. The title song is Play Free or Die, timely with the New Hampshire primary coming up.
Yes.
What were you thinking? What were you saying?
What was I saying? Actually, that's kind of an expression of my frustration with my home state of New Hampshire because basically growing up there and trying to play kind of new music there in the 70s, there was just nobody interested in it. And, you know, people always, oh, this isn't jazz, this isn't good, this isn't music. And I find it, and that was 25 years ago, and I find it really hasn't changed all that much since then. So
okay. Well, it's not really a Valentine to New Hampshire.
No, I don't think so.
Well, let's hear a little Play Free or Die. There's a part of Play Free or Die where it gets, you know, pretty out there, as some mm-hmm. might say. And our producer, Brad, who says his jazz is limited to Lisa on The Simpsons, mm-hmm. a fellow sax player.
Well, she's a wonderful baritone player.
Isn't she? Really. He asked, how do you arrange something like that? And I know it's, you know, it's Jazz 101, but a lot of people want to know, what does that look like on paper?
Well, it's a series of ideas, and you have to have players who have the ability to take your idea and make music out of it. For example, you know, I'll just have a phrase or something written there, and I'll say, well, okay, we have to improvise something that gets us from point A to point B, and work off of an element of point A, and work toward something that's going to suggest and set up point B. So it's really just a way, a creative language of getting musicians to create something that works in a structure that moves forward.
We've been listening to music from the second disc, which is your numbers and numbers of some of the greats that you've covered. It's so lyrical. And in contrast to CD 1 of mm-hmm. the 2-CD
yeah.
set, En Garde, this one's avant-garde.
Yeah.
Who or what were the musical influences here?
Well, my band, myself, you know, the people I've been listening to for years, mm-hmm. you know.
Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom, yeah, that's a series that I was working on. I still haven't finished it. I wanted to do a third part. I have Doom is Yours and Doom is Mine, and I wanted to do a third part called Doom is Ours, but I haven't finished it yet, so it's an ongoing work.
May I read from the liner notes of the song Doom is Yours by Charlie Colhase? May I?
Sure.
Doom is Yours. From the Dr. Doom suite, our heroes fall into the greasy clutch of the evil Dr. Doom. Can all be lost? The tension mounts with a chromatically climbing bass line. Then we move on to Doom is Mine. This is a march to Dr. Doom's chamber, interrupted by ATF agents coming to the rescue. Doc Doom realizes the worm has turned. Doom is mine. The bass moves in whole steps here. So are you telling us you're telling a story through a bass line?
Well, partly. I mean, the first part, Doom is Yours, when they're getting captured, there is this rising chromatic thing, and it rises constantly. It goes up the whole chromatic scale, and there is this tension to it.
Do something because obviously you're telling a story here, but some people might have a hard time following it musically. So we thought we'd just pick a segment of music from one part of Doom is Mine and then from another, and you can explain the shifts for us. Here's the first part. Thank you. very, you know, this is almost sound like a soundtrack. I wouldn't even call this avant-garde, really. I mean, it's very accessible. Musically, what's happening?
Musically, what's happening? Well, let's see. I'd say we're just coming out of the ensemble there. And it sounds to me like the ATF agents are gathering on the roof and getting ready to storm the place and save our heroes.
And then, within 2 minutes, we're here. What's happening there?
Oh, well, I'd say that there's definitely a battle going on between the ATF agents and Dr. Doom's forces of darkness right there.
Are you thinking that when you're playing?
I'm thinking about what the next thing to come up is. Or actually, I'm thinking about continuing the idea, but I'll tell you, that bass player there, John Turner, makes me so happy with his playing that, you know, it just gives you a... something to build to, you know.
One last question before you go. I'd asked you earlier, you know, where you hear you in your music. How would you define Charlie Colhase's sound? What is it?
I think it's jazz for the 21st century. It's it draws on elements from the whole history of the music from the 20s on up to the current era. Actually, the great Steve Lacy, who's one of my heroes, defines the current era of jazz as being the poly-free era, which means that we are free to play freely if we want. We are free to play the blues if we want. We're free to do anything we want with, you know, all this, you know, great resource of music that's developed over the years.
And you're compelled to do it. Play free or die. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you.
Charlie Colhase, leader of the Charlie Colhase Quintet. Their new double CD is called Play Free or Die.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
While Dr. Dean runs for president, the other doctor in the family works and races the kids back in Vermont. We'll look at the debate around Judith Steinberg Dean.
And we review the film, Along Came Polly.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.